You are listening to We Saw the Devil, an investigative and conversational true crime podcast that deep dives into fascinating criminal cases that are solved, unsolved, or ongoing. From America's Lori Vallow to Germany's Armin Mivas, we examine and discuss the world's most shocking cases. If you're enjoying the show, don't forget to follow us online. Check us out at WeSawTheDevil.com and WeSawTheDevil on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. And don't forget, you can become part of the show by backing us on Patreon. Hello, everyone. You are listening to We Saw the Devil. This is Robin. And as promised, I am back with a news update episode this week, just in time for your Saturday morning, your coffee, whatever it is you're doing. Hopefully you're not on the way to work, but if you are, Godspeed. So I'm here with an episode choosing headlines from this week that I'm personally really interested in. True crime news, headlines, cases, case updates that I came across or found kind of interesting. But before we get into that, I just have one really quick note, addendum to add to yesterday's episode that we put out. If you haven't listened yet, I just also published another episode. Brittany joined me to discuss the current Lori Vallow case news updates. We hadn't had a Lori Vallow update in well over a month, it seems. But we also discussed the craziness coming out of that Idaho funeral home where all of the bodies are being found. It looks like 12 plus adult bodies and then also over 50 fetuses, which is just mind-blowing. And there's an update on that as well, although I won't be including it in this episode. But two pieces from that episode, guys, because I've received a variety of comments. Number one is, while Brittany and I were discussing Tammy Daybell and the autopsy and her manner of death, I made the statement that a drug was found in her system. And I really wish that I hadn't done that. And it, unfortunately, it was something that happened because I discuss this case so frequently that sometimes I just can't shut my filter off, apparently. But I will say this. I have multiple sources close to the investigation and close to the case who have informed me that, yes, a drug was actually found in Tammy Daybell's autopsy. No, I will not name names. No, I will not tell anyone who they are, but I am taking this on very, 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 very good authority. I've known this for a little while now, and unfortunately, in discussion, it came out, and unfortunately, I did not catch it before I published the episode, or I would have edited that out. I'm so used to talking about this case. It just felt normal and I should have left that out. But yeah, take it, leave it, do as you wish with it. But that is what I have been advised by two sources who are close to the case. Alrighty, before we get into it, let's get some quick housekeeping out of the way. First, you can find us at wesawthedevil.com. From there, you can find our social media, Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, Patreon, all that good stuff. Also added, guys, is our new Discord channel. We have a new one for our patrons, but I've also created one for just general listeners. And this also goes out to you guys on like YouTube and stuff like that. As you'll see in the show notes or the video notes, you will see a bright, shiny new link to our Discord. Please feel free. It's open and welcome to everyone. Definitely hope to be engaging everyone personally there. So if you're looking to talk about true crime, anything related to true crime, interests, anything at all, please feel free. You're more than welcome to join our Discord and hang out and talk to us, get to know us, and discuss some cases. Beyond that, as we introduced last episode, head over to WSD Love and submit if you want some free shit. If you go to WSD Love, you'll see it. It says get your free shit. And all you have to do is just send a free submission. It takes 30 seconds to go through it. Basically, it's a monthly drawing. So it'll just take you 30 seconds to go through it, put your info in. And you get an extra entry if you leave a review on one of the podcast platforms, say like Apple, Stitcher, Podchaser, any one of those. You get an extra submission. Then you can enter every single month. And at the end of the month, every month, I'm going to be picking one person and then send you a gift. And I already have some really interesting ideas. Don't be scared. But yeah, it's going to be really, really fun. And we're going to do that each month. Alrighty, so let's just go ahead and get to the headlines, guys. I just vaguely touched on this last episode, but the Suzanne Morphew case. So Barry had his preliminary hearing. We're currently waiting on the judge to come back. He did not have a ruling on whether or not they were going to take him to trial. The judge did not make that decision on the 24th. So we have to wait until September 17th to receive that decision. Currently on countdown, but I did want to let everyone know in the previous episode, I kind of glossed over it, but we are in fact waiting September 17th, 6 more days, and we will learn if Barry Morphew will be headed to trial, which I hope so. This is a case that I am really, really, really invested in, more so than any case I can think of in a very long time. So this is definitely the primary case currently on my personal radar. And another case that entered my radar this week is the horrific slaying of Roy Jaggers. Roy was a 27-year-old Las Vegas man who had recently moved in to help with his ailing mother. He had been working as a contractor and electrician, but COVID-19 hit those areas pretty hard. So he had to find odd jobs in order to make ends meet. And that's how he ended up meeting 27-year-old Heather Pate. Heather Pate was a single mom who would occasionally call Roy to babysit her 3 and 4-year-old sons or dog sit while she was away. And right now, all investigators know is that somehow Heather Pate came to believe that Roy had hurt one of her sons. That's the only information that we have there. So on July 31st, Heather Pate lured Roy Jaggers to her home under the pretense of work. And there, he was immediately attacked by Heather Pate and her 36-year-old boyfriend, Kevin Dent. Roy was beaten and tortured in that home. And much of it was actually recorded on video, on cell phone video, with both Heather and Kevin taking turns exacting like horrible forms of cruelty upon Roy. He was then handcuffed and marched into Heather's car. Heather and Kevin drove to the Bell Vista shooting range where they met up with Heather's ex-boyfriend, 37-year-old Brad Mean. They then drove roughly 25 miles away to Cathedral Canyon, which is an old roadside attraction that's pretty much been shut down for many years. Now, I know we hear the word torture a lot when we read about true crime. It comes with the territory, right? This was legitimate, actual torture. He was burned with a blowtorch, had his genitals burned with a blowtorch. He was sliced open with knives. He was beaten with a baton and hit with an axe. Then he was stripped of his clothes and forced to walk off of a cliff. And at the bottom of the canyon, he was then shot multiple times with a shotgun. The next day, on August 1st, someone called in to report that a body had been found at the bottom of Cathedral Canyon. And investigators had to identify Roy Jaggers' body via fingerprints. The cause of death is listed as gunshot wounds. In the video evidence recovered by investigators, Pate's 2 young sons are actually seen in the video. They witnessed some of the violence committed by Heather Pate and Kevin Dent. And currently, thank God, the father of Heather Pate's children is currently seeking full custody. If there's ever been a case where I'm just like, just give the kids away to the father or, you know, the other spouse, like, this would definitely be it. They watched them physically torture a man before murdering him. Now, it's currently unknown if Roy Jaggers was actually guilty of any crime. Currently, there's no known evidence. And honestly, because of Heather Dent and 2 men in her life, no one's ever going to know the truth. Like, we will never know what actually transpired in this situation. Never. But that is definitely a very brutal crime that crept onto my radar this week. And I was just like, Jesus, just like, God. Alrighty, so moving on. Sirhan, he has been granted parole. He was the man who at age 24 murdered Robert F. Kennedy in 1968. And again, he was just granted parole after 52 years in prison. He was originally sentenced to death for the crime, but that sentence was commuted to life when the death penalty was outlawed in California. And it's interesting, specifically, legally speaking for me, Sirhan is both eligible for youth offender parole and elder offender parole. He's eligible for the youth offender parole, which took effect in its current form in January of 2018, and it applies to inmates who were under the age of 26 when they committed their crime. Again, Sirhan was 24. He also qualifies for the elderly parole program, which was modified last September to apply to inmates over 50 years of age who may have been incarcerated for at least 20 years. So he is definitely going to be on parole and released. And six of Robert F. Kennedy's sons spoke out against this decision, but two have come out in support. And the two that have come out in support have actually gone to visit him and spoken to him one-on-one. You know, this is a very significant crime in America's history. And the perpetrator, it's very rare that you actually see the perpetrator, the murderer, as it were, and you know, in this case, actually get released. But next up, we have an update in the Aiden Fucci case. If you recall, Aiden Fucci is the 14-year-old boy who stabbed cheerleader Tristan Bailey 114 times and then left her for dead. Horrifying, absolutely horrifying crime. Her body was found the same day on Mother's Day, May 9th. Crystal Smith, Aiden's mom, was arrested in June for one count of evidence tampering in connection to Tristan's murder. She apparently pleaded not guilty to that charge. But according to the arrest affidavit, and this is just gross, the video surveillance footage from Aiden and Crystal's home allegedly shows Crystal taking a pair of blue jeans from Aiden's room, washing them, and then returning the pants, returning the jeans. And investigators say in the affidavit that both the jeans and a drain in the bathroom at the home tested positive for blood. Also in this case, this past Wednesday, there was a pretrial hearing. Aiden was present via Zoom from the Duval County Jail where he's currently being held. And if you see, the video is available for public. You can find it here on YouTube. In the video, he appears very disoriented and out of it. He's rocking back and forth. He's very fidgety. And at one point he says, "Please don't let the demons take my soul. The demons are going to take my soul away." He also said things like, "Why am I here? What happened? I want to talk to my mom and dad." You know, guys, my opinion, for whatever it's worth, and I know it's not worth much, is that the defense is planting the seed for him to play incompetent. On this show, I talk a lot about the Lori Vallow case, and we've speculated and wondered if she's malingering, if Mark Means is having her play crazy in order to, you know, separate herself from Chad, and we've talked a great deal about that. At the end of the day, guys, my opinion is, I mean, a side note, my opinion in the Lori Vallow case is that I do believe that Chad was the mastermind of almost all of it. I believe that Lori was a religious zealot that was easily manipulated. I mean, granted that she can also be a terrible, murderous human being, but also be a religious zealot, brainwashed and, you know, cult victim, as it were, too. Do I believe that it's possible that Lori Vallow was isolated from Chad, taken away from, say, Melanie Boudreau and other people involved, and finally realizes the extent of her actions? Honestly, that's kind of where I'm at now. Like, that's honestly kind of where I am at, especially after this extension with Lori Vallow. That being said, though, Aiden Fucci, I do not believe he is incompetent. I believe that that was an act. It looked very forced to me when he was doing that. I mean, he was smiling in the police car. He even asked how she was, how they found her. The little dude has some very, very, very disturbing behavior. One thing on this show that I refuse to do is try to diagnose someone with some sort of mental disorder. Will not do it. Not my expertise. And I also find it pretty grody when even psychiatrists or medical professionals diagnose in YouTube videos. But he definitely seemed aware of what he did, his actions, and he appeared to be pretty cool and calculating about it. And then an awful tragedy this past week, guys. Around 4 a.m. on September 5th, police in Lakeland, Florida, heard active gunshots coming from an area and responded to the scene. As per usual in cases like these, calls about an active shooter began to flood the emergency communication center. The police located the property where the gunshots were being shot off at and saw a suspicious man dressed head to toe in body armor. He ran inside and barricaded the door. Police were finally able to eventually gain entry, and then there was a massive firefight. Police shot the perp one time and were able to take him into custody. But it wasn't over. He apparently, while being treated for his gunshot wound, tried to grab a police officer's gun, and then a brawl ensued in the emergency room as well. But back to the house. When officers gained entry, they immediately discovered an 11-year-old girl who had been shot multiple times, in the stomach as well as in the thigh. She was transported to the hospital to undergo surgery, and she is very stable now, but she fought for her life for several days. Also in the house, police discovered four bodies. One was a mother who was found deceased holding her also dead infant, and they had both been shot multiple times. They also found a 33-year-old man, and then the fourth victim was the infant's 62-year-old grandmother, and she was found shot to death in another home on the same property, kind of like an outlaw suite, like an in-law suite. Currently, what we do know is that the gunman is 33-year-old Brian Riley. He was a Marine Corps veteran and served in both Iraq and Afghanistan. He spent 4 years in the Marine Corps before being honorably discharged and then spent another 3 years in the reserves. He had been working security detail at a local church, and his girlfriend told investigators that he suffered from severe PTSD, but that he had never been violent. And there are multiple reports, too, of the church being like, he worked here for 2 hours. Like, we don't know who he is, and he hasn't worked there in a while. Again, multiple conflicting reports, but I guess that's not really, really a big piece of this. Police have released some information from their interview with Riley, and he described himself as a survivalist and told them, quote, "You know why I did this. They begged for their lives, but I shot them anyway." Brian Riley is currently being charged with the following: 4 counts of first-degree murder, 7 counts of attempted murder of a law enforcement officer, 2 counts of shooting into a building, 2 counts of armed burglary with assault and battery, second-degree arson, and attempted murder in the first degree with a weapon. The victims' names: Justice Gleason, age 40, Teresa Lanham, 33, Justice Gleason and Teresa Lanham's 3-month-old son, and then Teresa's mother, 62-year-old Kathy Delgado. The incident initially unfolded starting on Saturday, the day before, Saturday, September 4th, my birthday, nonetheless, when Brian Riley allegedly saw Justice Gleason outside of his home as he was mowing his front yard. Riley asked Gleason and said, "Hey, God sent me to speak with a girl named Amber who lives at this residence. She's a sex trafficking victim and I'm here to save her." Justice Gleason informed Brian Riley that no one with that name was living at their address, and then he demanded that Riley leave. A little small argument ensued. Riley was like, "No, I need to save this girl." Justice told him to GTFO and that he was going to call the police. Brian Riley did leave the residence. Justice Gleason also reported this interaction to police. They called police. Police were dispatched. They looked around for him and they did not see him. Unfortunately, that was not the end of it. Brian Riley returned the next day on the 5th at 4 a.m., and that's when he allegedly shot Gleason and the 3 other family members dead. He apparently went home to his girlfriend, told her about the sex trafficking and whatnot, and she was like, "Okay, sweetie, it's okay." They got into an argument over it with her telling him, you know, God is not speaking to you, because Brian Riley had been telling her for a couple weeks, apparently the 2 weeks prior, that God was speaking to him directly and telling him that he needs to save this girl named Amber. But he really did believe that he was on a mission from God to save this girl named Amber. He and his girlfriend got into an argument over it. She went to bed, and when she woke up, he was gone, and all of this was unfolding. So Brian Riley went back to Justice Gleason's home, and he treated this and planned this like a military operation. He admitted this to investigators. He checked for 3 points of entry. He checked the streets. He brought glow sticks to put near exits. He ended up, before he launched the attack, he set a vehicle on fire so that police would respond to it before they actually responded to the home. He staked it out. He initially tried to break into a door that didn't work, so he just shot through and then entered the home. As Brian Riley was making his way into the home, he murdered Justice Gleason first. Then he murdered Teresa Lanham as she was holding her 3-month-old son, and then shot both of them multiple times. The 11-year-old girl was there as well, and Brian Riley allegedly escorted her into the living room where he questioned her about an 11-year-old girl named Amber. The girl insisted that she didn't know an Amber, no one by that name lived in that home, and so Riley shot her in the thigh and told her to tell him the truth. Again, she doubled down and was like, "I don't know what you're talking about," and so he shot her in the stomach after counting down from 3, 3, 2, 1. She told investigators that she saved her own life by pretending to be dead after he shot her in the stomach. Now, can you imagine watching someone murder your parents and your three-month-old sibling, and you have to pretend to be dead on the floor after being shot twice, and you're 11 years old? I cannot even fathom that. Brian Riley is currently being held at the Polk County Jail on no bond, and apparently he is still telling investigators that he is there to help Amber. And that sex trafficking is the big problem, which honestly, I'm wondering if that is a Q, like QAnon reference. But overall, horrible, horrible, horrible tragedy out of Lakeland, Florida. Alrighty, guys. And now onto a case that I've been obsessed with this case for a week now. It is a rabbit hole of all rabbit holes. And I actually have an amazing podcast suggestion for you. If you haven't started listening to this podcast, please, 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 please do so. This is a mystery of mysteries, and I don't even think that I have my own head wrapped around it quite yet, but the podcast is excellent. And I know that I've seen people in a lot of true crime groups on Facebook and Reddit and whatnot mention this case, so I'm so glad that it's finally getting the exposure that it deserves. I'm talking about the Murdaugh Murders. The podcast I'm referring to is the Murdaugh Murders podcast, which is hosted by journalist Mandy Matney. This is an absolute shit show, you guys. Here's the, you know, setting. Like, Sicily, 1923. The lowlands of South Carolina. Prominent legal family. Three generations of men in this family have held the solicitor's job in this, like, low country, in this region. Very, very, very powerful post. And it's a family called the Murdaughs. The dad, his name is Alex Murdaugh. He used to hold a solicitor's job, went private, and worked for a prominent law firm. Well, there has been a series of really suspicious and unfortunate events that have befallen the Murdaugh family, okay? It's Murdaugh, his wife Maggie, and his two sons, Buster and Paul. Okay, so let's start with one son. Let's start with Paul. Over a year ago, Paul, 22 years old, was driving a boat, and he was drunk as a skunk. Everybody on the boat was like begging him to stop. By multiple accounts, his girlfriend at the time asked him to slow down, and he slapped, spit on, and pushed her down the boat right before he drove into a column in the river, like a bridge column. Well, the boat crashed and it killed a passenger. So he was awaiting court for a lethal boat crash. That's Paul Murdaugh. And then another local man, his name was Stephen Smith, and he was an openly gay man in this region, in this area in South Carolina, which, let me tell you, it ain't friendly in the South for the most part. Stephen Smith died suspiciously as well. And it's rumored that he had an intimate relationship with Buster Murdaugh, Murdaugh's other son. Stephen Smith was found on a desolate road in rural South Carolina without any identification whatsoever. And at first, police believed that it was a homicide because there were no skid marks, broken glass, car pieces, doors, like any hallmarks of, say, an accident, right? Someone hitting him, road rage, or just regular accident. But then the highway patrol and investigators came upon information that indicated that the Murdaugh family could potentially be involved in it. That information has not been released to the public. But right after that happened, the cause of death quickly changed from homicide to hit and run. At first, it was homicide. Yeah, someone basically whacked him in the back of the head. There was a great deal of head trauma to, oh, well, no, that didn't happen. This is easily explained by him, a semi-truck hitting him. That has to be the side mirror of the semi-truck that caved in his head. As soon as the Murdaugh family was mentioned, that cause of death immediately changed. And then there's a housekeeper. And guys, I'm keeping the details very light so you can delve into this and get the full experience of the Murdaugh Murders podcast. A woman in her 50s was a housekeeper for the Murdaugh family. She ended up dying mysteriously as well. It was basically a fall accident, like an accident by falling death. And her family ended up suing the Murdaughs. Alex Murdaugh ended up taking basically like insurance out and whatnot and paid her family $500,000. Very suspicious. Something happened. She fell somewhere in the Murdaugh home and it caused her death. That's what we know. All right. So June 7th, 2021, just a couple months ago, guys, Alex Murdaugh, the dad, discovers the bodies of his son, Paul, and wife, Maggie, on their 1,770-acre hunting lodge. He calls 911 at 10:07 p.m. He says, "I need the police and ambulance immediately. My wife and child have been shot badly." And the cavalry was dispatched to the Murdaugh residence. Both Maggie Murdaugh and Paul Murdaugh, yes, the one that was in deep shit for the fatal boat accident, were found shot multiple times. They were both deceased. And at the time, for the last couple months, this has been treated as just like your standard homicide investigation, right? Also, later in June, a couple weeks after the murders, Alex Murdaugh, the dad, his brothers, also, again, prominent attorneys, they appear on ABC News and they plead for the public, come forward if you have any information. We don't know what's going on. Someone, you know, murdered these people. A family that's prominent in this area, you know, everything, all rocks were basically turned over. So while investigators were investigating the murder of Paul and Maggie, they found a shit ton of information that led to other things, like that the Murdaugh family may have been involved in the death of Stephen Smith. Then, guys, let's go back to my birthday here. This last Saturday, September 4th, Alex Murdaugh, the dad, right? He's lost his wife. He lost one son, just him and one other son. He shot in the head while changing a tire in Hampton County. And he is currently hospitalized in Savannah, but said to be conscious, awake, and speaking. He claims that he was on the side of the road changing a tire. Someone came up, said something to him, turned around, and shot him in the head. It is suspicious, to say the least. The day before this happened, he had to resign in shame, embarrassment, from his major, major, major prominent law firm that he's been working at because he was more or less busted embezzling and stealing money, like internal, like partners' funds. So he quit. And then the next day, suddenly he's shot in the head and it grazes just the back of his head, though. Definitely a wound, but it more or less grazes is what all of the reporting has said. So, of course, this has basically the world whipped up into a frenzy now. How can someone, I mean, this family who was known as being like bullies, like they, if you were on their shit list, you had no chance in life. Like they were known for being ruthless and cruel and awful. The drama meter here is basically going off the charts. Currently, authorities have not identified any motive or any suspects in the killing of Maggie and Paul, right? Like the wife and son. No suspects, no motive. And then Alex Murdaugh just ended up shot in the head this last weekend. Today, his attorney, Amanda Loveday, put out a statement because I think at this point, everybody's like, okay, well, maybe he murdered his wife and son. You know, he quit in shame. He didn't want to get charged. His son was an embarrassment and basically killed a girl out of negligence. His wife probably knew too much. Like, basically, the speculation wheels have been turning. So in response to that, Alex Murdaugh's attorney put out a statement. It says, quote, "It was not a self-inflicted wound. There has been some misreporting regarding Alex Murdaugh and his shooting on September 4th. So he wanted to clear up a number of facts from that day. After the shooting, Alex had an entry and exit wound. His skull was fractured and it was not a self-inflicted bullet wound. Alex pulled over after seeing a low tire indicator light. A male driver in a blue pickup asked him if he had car troubles. As soon as Alex replied, he was shot. She then went on to say that police are still investigating and looking for a suspect." And guys, I left so much out of this, like as far as details, but I'm just trying to give you like the base story and whatnot, the basic plot points. But yeah, check out the Murdaugh Murders podcast. It's hosted by a local journalist there in South Carolina. Her name is Mandy Matney. They've been covering this family for a very long time because this family has been getting away with just heinous amounts of shit for decades. And Mandy Matney has been covering it. She's their local, and she has put up an incredible podcast about this. And it just dives so deeply into it and the evidence and investigative reporting. So check that out. All right. So moving on. And this case just absolutely just appalls me. Do you guys remember the story out of Phoenix, Arizona, back from 2018? Nathan Sutherland is a former licensed practical nurse from Hacienda Healthcare, and he was accused of sexually assaulting and impregnating a woman who was in a vegetative state. At the time, the woman was 29 years old, and she was unable to verbally communicate, only more or less make noises. Her family has said that she, quote, has significant intellectual disabilities as a result of seizures very early in her childhood. She does not speak, but she has some ability to move her limbs, head, and neck. She responds to sound and is able to make facial gestures. I was not aware until this case just resurfaced that she's been in that facility since she was 2 years old, just laying in a bed since she was 2 years old. That's also heartbreaking to me. Released medical records indicate that the woman lacks sufficient understanding and mental capacity to make decisions or give consents for her medical placement or financial estate. It says that she suffers from quadriplegia, recurrent pneumonia, as well as a seizure disorder. So how did Hacienda Healthcare discover that this woman was pregnant? Well, guys, they discovered this when she was actively going into labor. When she was actively giving birth, like on the pathway to giving birth. Basically, after this was done and after a baby appeared, an internal investigation was done and Nathan Sutherland supplied a DNA sample due to his scheduling and exposure to her, and it was a match. The baby was born and is currently being cared for by the woman's mother. They did end up keeping this baby and taking them in to raise as their own. Now, Nathan Sutherland did voluntarily and immediately surrender his nursing license upon his arrest. As soon as that happened, a lot of shit went on at Hacienda Healthcare. The CEO stepped down. They suspended the doctor who oversaw her care. It caused another one to resign. And then there was a huge, huge, huge internal review of the entire situation. The woman's family ended up suing the entire state of Arizona, saying that it was grossly negligent with its oversight of Hacienda Healthcare. Some of the reasons that they listed in the original suit, they claimed that Hacienda missed many, 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 many signs that she was pregnant. She gained a significant amount of weight. Her belly was swollen, you know, like a pregnant belly. And she also stopped having her periods in the months before the baby was actually born. And Hacienda Healthcare replied to this at the time, right? Like all of these changes in symptoms, they actually reduced her nutrition. The woman has a feeding tube, and Hacienda Healthcare actually reduced her nutrition due to the weight gain. So what happened is this actually caused her to give birth to a child while both malnourished and dehydrated. Since they also did not know she was pregnant, she also gave birth without any sort of pain medication or pain management. So the family ended up settling with the state of Arizona for $7.5 million. The reason why this case is back in the news is that Nathan Sutherland just pleaded guilty. He entered a guilty plea this last Thursday to a charge of sexual abuse and also sexual abuse of a vulnerable adult. The plea agreement calls for a sentence of 5.25 to 10 years in prison on the sexual assault conviction and also a lifetime probation on the other. Sentencing is scheduled for November 4th. Sexual assault against an incapacitated person, someone who's not able in any capacity to give consent, I don't even care. Just let him languish, let him rot. No second thoughts here. Alrighty, guys, so that brings us to the final headline. This one is actually one that just tickled me pink. Prince Andrew has finally been served. If you've been following any of the numerous podcasts, television shows, documentaries, investigative stories, you know that Prince Andrew was connected to Jeffrey Epstein and Ghislaine Maxwell and is part of that entire mess. And also that Virginia Roberts claims that Jeffrey Epstein and Ghislaine Maxwell more or less trafficked her for sex to Prince Andrew. Prince Andrew has been dodging servers, like process servers, for weeks now. Well, he was finally served. It has been confirmed at 9:30 a.m. on August 27th at his Royal Lodge residence in Windsor. So good news there. I hope Virginia Roberts just absolutely nails him in this suit. I truly hope She is just one of the most badass women, strong beyond belief, taking all of this on and becoming just a very, very, very public face and trying to get some sort of justice. And if you have any shadow of a doubt that Prince Andrew is even involved in this, which I think 99% of you like probably agree and know that he is, go to YouTube and search for the video of Prince Andrew showing up in the middle of the night, uninvited, to Courtney Love's Hollywood home back in like the early 2000s, late 90s. He is an absolute disgusting piece of shit. Like, I remember this video years ago when Courtney posted it. I'm a huge Hole fan. Like, Hole is actually one of my absolute favorite bands. But I remember when she posted and mentioned it, and I watched it, and I'm just like, wow. So he's definitely a creepo. But I really, really hope that we are going to see some sort of justice for one of the players here in this entire debacle of the Epstein galaxy. But that's it for today, guys. As always, thank you for listening. You can find us at wesawthedevil.com. All of our social media is there. Look in the links or the show notes. You'll find links to basically everything from our social media, our website, our Patreon. If you want to support the show financially, you can do so there and get some cool stuff. And then also WSD Love, leave a review, get some free shit, or just enter. We'd really love and appreciate you for it. And then also our new shiny Discord link. If you guys want to, you know, chat about true crime, talk about cases that you are interested in, and form a community around that, please join us in our Discord link below or in the show notes. Until next crime.